here's what has been happening. Prices have been coming down at the same pace as the increase in interest rate. So there's no, from what I can discern, there's been no change in cash flow. Cash flow was really sucky 18 months ago and is really sucky today. But what has changed is that today, the average price of a property is, you know, when adjusted for net operating income, is down between 15 and 25%.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Today we have a guest who I could not be more excited about, Neil Bawa. Ryan, how you doing, man? We've known Neil forever, right?
Yeah, it goes back at least 6+ years. I remember seeing him for the first time at the Best Ever Conference on stage. Actually, he shared the stage with my wife, which is hilarious. She talked about RV park investing, and he talked about student housing. You can actually watch that on YouTube somewhere. I don't know. We'll try to throw a link in the show notes. My wife might kill me for doing that. But Neil is very animated. He's very passionate, and he's very good with data. And he is going to dive into a number of topics to include where we are with the economy, which at the end, halfway through the show, you're going to love that. He is going to give you a ton of information about the economy. And then he talks in about multifamily. And then we even get into like artificial intelligence and how that's changing society at the very end. And then we talk about this really cool thing called build to rent, which everybody, every investor needs to at least be aware of, if not investing in. So anything else that I missed, Tate?
He's known as the mad scientist of real estate. He's a data scientist at heart, a geek. He's very data-driven in all of his analytics. He's a wealth of knowledge. So yeah, I just can't wait to get to the conversation. Let's get into it. Neil Bawa, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for coming on.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. Very exciting. Good to see Ryan again.
Good to see you. I think the first time I met you actually was in 2017, the Best Ever Conference. You were on stage talking about student housing. And my wife was on the panel with you. I don't know if you remember that, but she was talking about RV park investing. So I'm happy to have you on the show. Welcome.
Awesome. Well, 6 years. Wow. It's been a crazy 6 years.
It sure has. Yeah.
And I think I was at that same conference. And Ryan, we were also at a conference, 2 months ago in Salt Lake City this year, Best Ever Conference. And you were knocking out of the park as usual. So I really want to just ask the question that's on everybody's mind. Like, what's happening here? Like, where are we?
Well, I think my straightforward answer to the question is it's all about cycles. There was this belief, this irrational belief in the multifamily industry that somehow multifamily or somehow the syndication portion of multifamily was exempt from the rule of cycles. And it's now being comprehensively proven that we weren't. There was also this belief, and to some extent, I shared that belief, by the way, that there was so much demand and so much powder on the sidelines that, you know, even as interest rates go up, there would be somehow a cushion under cap rates that would be placed there. While that belief has proven to be true, the cushion was a lot thinner than we thought. So a lot of that capital was rational capital. A lot of that capital was ultra patient capital. And they're still, you know, gritting their teeth and still sitting on the sidelines, because what's really happened is in the last 15 months, as prices of multifamily properties have gone down, and we've seen other asset classes also go down, by the way, you know, just a rationalization has happened. We've seen industrial drop, we've seen office crater. What's really happened is that capital that we were all betting on, this you know, trillions of dollars on the sideline, has just basically said, you know, perhaps we should be on the sideline a little bit longer. And so what we are seeing is that the only thing that's actually keeping up the prices of the largest asset class in commercial real estate, which is multifamily, is supply or the lack thereof. There's a lack of supply, right? Well, this number, I think, is interesting. So I think it was CBRE or Berkadia that said that compared to 12 months ago, only 22% of the properties are available for sale, right? So when you kill 78% of the supply, that certainly can drive up prices to a certain level. And so that's actually put a floor under pricing. It hasn't been this trillions of dollars of institutional capital. They're still sitting on the sideline saying the mathematics isn't working.
Right.
Yeah. So right. My question is multifamily in trouble because operators took the wrong debt or because of the fundamentals of multifamily?
So my answer is, in general, it's not the fundamentals at all. Because, you know, when you look at fundamentals, I'll give you an example just so that, you know, your listeners can relate to it, right? Pre-COVID, the occupancy rate for office in the United States, right, general office in the United States was 89%. And then 89% is still a little bit on the lower side, but it's not terrible, right? But most offices can sort of break even if their occupancy is 85, 86, 87. Today, that occupancy is 79% and dropping by 1% a month. I'm not talking about any one market. I'm talking about office for the United States. So it's at 79, which means that the entire industry, the office industry, for the most part, is unviable. And it's dropping by 1% a month. And that's a staggering number. Now, that is an example of there's something wrong with the fundamentals. When you look at the multifamily industry, when you look at the peak of the multifamily industry, let's call it 18 months ago, right? 17, 18 months ago, Q4 of 2021 and Q1 of 2022 were the two quarters that are considered the peak for this cycle. And since then, prices have come down. But if you look at the fundamentals, what are the fundamentals? The fundamentals of multifamily are basically tied to two things. One, occupancy, and two, rents. People's ability to pay and people's interest in paying. Those are the two that we call fundamentals. Well, occupancy has dropped by 1%. So we've gone from 96.5% at peak to 95.1%, 5%. And some of the bubblier markets have actually fallen 2%. So they've gone to 94.5% simply because they have a large amount of new supply coming in that's now delivering. That is not a change in fundamentals. Now let's talk about rents, right? So we've had, if you look at a one-year time frame, we've had zero rent growth in multifamily. So if you look across the board in the last 12 months, no rent growth, right? Which means that rent growth is negative. And people are like, no, you just said it was flat. No, inflation is at 5%. If you look at the 10 years of inflation that we had from 1974 to 1984, which were the high inflation years, that's really the only example of high inflation that the US has, rents were higher than inflation. So in a year that inflation was 8, rents were 9. In a year that inflation was 9, rents were 11 or 12. So rents typically stay higher than inflation. So if you've had 5 to 6% inflation in the last 12 months and flat rents, rents are actually declining. So there's a little bit of a decline there. However, because Ryan's asking a question about fundamentals, I want to point out to you that looking at any one year is a really bad example, especially if that particular year had a 500 basis point swing in interest rates. So let's look at 2 years. So we combine the last 12 months with the 12 months before that, and we have 6% rent growth per year on average. So fundamentals really haven't changed at all for multifamily. What has really happened is irrational buying. So I'll give you a number. In 2021 and 2022, those 3 years, 2021, 2022, roughly 30% of all properties that were purchased by syndicators, and I'm not talking about the rest of the market, the syndicators are a small portion of the multifamily market, roughly 30% of those properties are bleeding, right? And the number could be a little bit higher for certain markets like Phoenix and could be a little bit lower for markets like Columbus or Cincinnati or Cleveland, right, which are cheaper markets. So 30% of those properties are bleeding. And bleeding is not easy to do. I mean, it's not easy to make a property bleed unless you're buying them at 3 caps. So this irrational behavior during the peak in 2021, where a lot of properties were purchased for 3 cap actual, people sort of made up numbers to make them seem more like 4 cap, but it was really 3 cap, 3.5 cap actual. A ton of those properties cannot support the interest rates that we have today. So I have numbers, thankfully, day before yesterday, Yardi Matrix actually came out with the numbers of properties that they consider to be in distress. So as we go through this, I can actually share those with you. And I think it's terrific data. But bottom line is that there are 3,000 properties with a DSCR or debt coverage ratio of 1 or less. And right. And I can quantify the impact of what that does to the industry in the next 12 months. But really, the starting number is this: There's 3,000 large multifamily properties that are either in distress or about to be in distress.
Can you just give us a context of what percentage of the large multifamily space that is, so that we have a good idea? Because 3,000, is that a big number or a small number in the grand scheme?
Yeah. So the short answer is, I mean, the entire multifamily space, and I'm only referring to the large multifamily space. So let's just call it, 100 units and above, sort of, as a benchmark number, somewhere in the 20,000-25,000 property range. So I want to point out to you that I believe what is actually happening, and this was really the question that you guys opened with, right? What's happening is the multifamily syndication market is in distress and about to be in greater distress. The multifamily market in the United States is not in distress and is unlikely to get into distress. Because when you have 20,000 properties, of which 2,500 or 3,000 are really the maximum number of properties that are likely to be in distress, because the rest of those properties have one of two great things that have happened, or both. One, they have a fixed rate. Two, they've been bought 5 years ago or 6 years ago or 10 years ago. So at this point, their rents have increased so much that all they're doing is taking a big hit, right? So they're taking a big hit. And even if they are at a bridge level, well, investors have already pulled their money out 3 times already. So at this point, it's not like the property is quote unquote at distress. Even if they go out and sell the property for lower than what they think they were going to sell it, they've already made their investor money back. I wouldn't call that distress in any way, right? And it's very likely that they'll just figure out a way to hold on to that property by simply not distributing the cash flow that they have been distributing successfully for a number of years. So keep in mind, it's a big industry. The vast majority of it is not inside the syndication bubble, and there isn't a lot of evidence to support that portion of the industry is going to have significant distress. There is a lot of evidence to suggest that the syndication portion of the multifamily industry is already in distress, and I'll give you anecdotes on that, and is likely to be in much greater distress in the coming 12 months.
Yeah, because Neil, I'll be honest. I went to an institutional investors forum, and I dabble in that every once in a while. And I raised my hand and I asked about, how the multifamily allocations in their portfolios are doing. And they had glowing reviews. And, I kind of hinted in my question, unfortunately, that was like that multifamily was in distress. And they basically looked at me like, what the hell are you talking about?
Because, and I think that that's right. Right. Yeah. I mean, a lot of these institutional investors, a bunch of them, did not do what the syndicators did. Keep in mind, syndicators get a overwhelming majority of their money from retail investors, $50,000 to $100,000 at a time. So I would even speculate that I believe less than 10% of all money that syndicators raise comes from institutional sources. So I think you have this very two-faced market where a bunch of people who have made these investments have made them in a different rational methodology and are okay with it, or they have fixed debt. So as far as they're concerned, they're doing swimmingly. And then you have this bridge debt issue that is more tied to the syndication piece. So I'm not surprised at what you heard in these institutional events. It's very two-faced.
Yeah. So I think what's happened is in the run-up to the end of 2021, 2022, there was some new syndicators that got into multifamily that maybe got in and got out, made a huge home run or a couple of base hits. And then they kept buying and buying and buying and buying without fundamentals. And sort of the old adage, when the tide goes out, you can see who's swimming naked or whatever it is, right? And I think maybe that's what you're suggesting is there was these magicians that were making really great money in these investments. But then when the tide went out, it was like you could see really the basics that were wrong with some of these fundamentals. Which, can you kind of speak to that a little bit? Yeah, go ahead.
And just for example, what Ryan is talking about, I mean, we saw many, many deals in 2021 and 2022 that the underwriting didn't work unless there was a refinance in year three. If you took the refinance out, it was a terrible deal. And so they were relying on interest rates staying low and prices continuing to appreciate. So anyway, Neil, I'll let you respond to that.
Yeah, I'll start with an anecdote, right? So a student of mine, opened a company, again, not to be named, and took training from me, went into Phoenix, and in that time frame ended up buying, from what I can tell, between 8 and 12 properties. And from what I can tell, all of them were purchased under 4 cap. And what was interesting is that my underwriting team, every time they would get an email from this company about a raise, would bring it to me and say, see, they're able to buy this. This is one of your students. He's able to buy four or five properties a year, but you're not permitting us to buy these properties because of the underwriting rules that you've set for me. And so during that 24-month timeframe, I ended up buying a single value-add property, which luckily I was able to get at 5 cap in a small town called Killeen that most people haven't even heard of. And then I bought a second property, which was my own property, which I basically, I had some partners then and I wanted to buy them out. So I basically got the market price and I matched it because I knew just how good that property was. And I didn't have to make conservative assumptions when, you know, it's my own property. I'll just look at the actual numbers and I know those numbers are right. So other than that, I just sat on my ass and did nothing. And all along, Ryan, all along, Tate, I was wondering, how are these people making these numbers work? I made up stories in my head. I made up stories like, maybe they have institutional investors from Qatar or Saudi, and those people are okay with making no cash flow. Or maybe they have, you know, the Norwegian sovereign fund, which is $1 trillion, and those people are okay with 12% IRR or something like that. I mean, I made up stories in my head, but I wasn't able to reconcile what was happening in the marketplace. And it was especially galling for me that dozens of my past students were basically going out and doing this. And I guess they sort of ignored all of the chapters that I had about market cycles and cap rates and, you know, how, you know, it's very easy to fool yourself into believing that the returns are there. I think that these people were not bad people, but most mistakes that have been made in market cycles have been made by good people with good intentions.
You know, people have been buying stuff at 3 or 4 caps for a long time and they've been successful. What were the indicators that you saw to make you jump on the brakes and slow down?
So one of the things that I've been saying for a long time is, you know, when you see a market and you see a property in that market that, you know, you're buying at 3.5 cap, but you know that that property, you know, once you rehab it, you can basically push up your cap rate, right? So you can make that property into a 5.5 or 6 cap property. But what I started to see is in many bubbly markets in the US, with sort of Phoenix being the poster child of that, every single market, every single property was saying that. And the big question that I had in my mind is, what happens to all the people that live here that cannot afford the rehabbed property? So when you're in a market that has 1,000 properties, you rehab the first 300, you get your rent bumps. You rehab the next 200, now you're struggling. What happens when you rehab the last 500? None of the people living in those properties can actually afford to pay the higher rent. So how do you hit those numbers? And I was beginning to see markets where syndicators were dominating, meaning 7, 8, 9 out of all 10 properties that were being purchased of any size were by syndicators. So I came to the conclusion that at some point you can't, you know, get the rent bumps you want, even though you've done everything right, simply because every single property in the market is now rehabbed, or most of them are. And so there's no place for the lower end tenant to live. And I think we are now seeing that in a number of markets. And that's what upsets the 3.5 to 4 cap that you're talking about, right? When you're doing it on 1 property out of 10, the math works. When you're doing it on 8 out of 10, it doesn't work.
Now compare that to today. So, okay, we've got 3,000 of 25,000 properties that are distressed at below a 1 DSCR. And we have syndicators that are going to be treading water or drowning. And we have investors, right, that may be impacted by this or are already being impacted. How do we go forward from here? Because like you said, multifamily fundamentally is strong. I mean, only 1% dip in occupancy and arguably 6% continued rent growth. Maybe that'll slow down a little bit as we combine years 2023 and 2024. But what are you tracking now and where do you see the opportunities?
I think the opportunity going forward into the next 12 months is multi-pronged and it's much stronger. Like, you know, I gave you my frustrations in the last 2 years. I've basically ended up buying almost nothing. I did recently buy a property after the prices came down. So it was a property that we had made an offer on 18 months ago that we weren't even close to winning. Like we were off by millions of dollars. And then basically came back on the market and we made an offer that was 18% below that number and the market offer got accepted. So I bought one. But in general, though, I'm really waiting for the future because here's what has been happening. Prices have been coming down at the same pace as the increase in interest rate. So from what I can discern, there's been no change in cash flow. Cash flow was really sucky 18 months ago and is really sucky today. But what has changed is that today, the average price of a property is, for, you know, when adjusted for net operating income, is down between 15 and 25%, with, you know, Phoenix maybe being the 25% market and some of the Rust Belt markets, ironically, being the ones that are more in the 12 to 15% range, because they hadn't seen such a big run up, so they haven't seen such a big drop either. And the cash flow there was higher. So bottom line is that we are seeing prices adjust. That is a big deal. That is a huge deal, because on a NOI adjusted basis, we are seeing that 15 to 25% drop. So I would venture to say that today is actually a much better time to buy than 6, 12, or 18 months ago for a number of reasons. Number one, the Fed's clearly stopped. They removed that, their continuing language, that very important sentence that everyone looks for. So is it possible that they might raise by another quarter point in June? Maybe. I mean, there's currently... The Wall Street feels 97 out of 100 Wall Street analysts feel that the Fed is done, right? Because remember, even staying at this level, they're putting an enormous amount of downward pressure on the economy. They don't really have to go up there. It's like you already have a 100-pound chest, you know, rock on the chest of the economy. Do you really need to make this 100-pound rock 105 pounds, right? So you just wait a little bit longer, and it has the same impact. So we think the Fed's going to plateau for 3, 4, 5 months, and maybe around November or December is when they start a rate drop cycle. So bottom line is, just knowing that the Fed seems like we're done puts us in a better position on how to do our calculations, how to do our cap rate, exit cap calculations. So we're in a better position. Second, we're paying 15 to 25% less. That's very important, because you make your money on the buy, not on the sell, right? Third, If you are able to make the assumption, and I'm certainly one of those people making the assumption, that interest rates will be lower than 2024 and 2025, then going forward, your underwriting shouldn't be that terrible. It may be pretty terrible today, but as you go forward and interest rates start to come down, you can start to make, let's call it, more bullish assumptions, right? I am assuming that cap rates are going to recompress to some level, hopefully not to the madness that we saw in 2021, but recompress, right? So because when I look at the fundamentals, when I look at the demand, I know that interest rates, when interest rates go down, people will be willing to pay more. Right now, there's people willing to pay more than they should be paying. So when rates go down, why wouldn't they pay more? So to me, this is actually an interesting time to be making purchases. You're not at the bottom of the market, clearly not at the bottom, but you're getting closer to the bottom. And the second is, I expect that these 2,500 properties with a DSCR of 1 or below, a significant portion of them are going to come into the marketplace in the next 12 months. So that's going to drive the price down even further than it should be. Now I'm saying, hey, we might get discounts that we shouldn't be getting. Well, distress creates unreasonable discounts, but it only creates them for a window of time. So I think in the next 12 months, we might actually see a bigger discount than we should be getting, given the very strong fundamentals of multifamily and given the outrageous amount of demand.
Neil, I want to touch on a strategy that we're increasingly seeing in multifamily is the public facilities corporations, these tax-exempt entities. We just did a deal where it's in Texas. Property taxes are very high, 2% of assessed value. And in exchange for rent restricting, 50% of the units were able to exempt property tax on that property for 99 years. And it's transferable to the next buyer. What are your thoughts on that? And what are your thoughts on that as a strategy? Whereas, we'd be going into this property at about a 4.25 cap, and instead we're hitting it at about a 6.1.
I think it's a great strategy that is beginning to work now. So firstly, I know rents were, fairly flat over the last year, but really over the last 2 years, they've risen about 16 or 17%. So that allows you to get more rent out of your non-exempt units, right? Your portion of your property is capped, the other portion's not, but that other portion that's not has a significant, bump. I think that strategies like this are going to proliferate. I think that other states will pass laws allowing more of these strategies to happen, because I think that that is the way that states can essentially do rent control without rent control, right? This is rent control without rent control, because you're not basically putting any kind of cap on market prices. They can go as high as they want. But what you're doing is you're basically giving property tax incentives. Now, in the end, though, I can tell you this, Tate, the math in my mind is clear. This doesn't solve America's housing problem simply because the housing problem is so large, right? And we hear, you know, 4 million units. I don't believe that, by the way. I believe the 1.7 million number that comes from Ivy Zelman of Zelman & Associates, I believe that number. Still, 1.7 million units short for sure. Bottom line is that you would drive a lot of states and a lot of cities to bankruptcy right. if you basically took this strategy and rolled it out across 100,000, you know, properties, simply because those property taxes are what they use to pay their employees. They're what they use to make roads and you know, right. sewage and pipes. So I think the strategy, wherever you can make it work, is very powerful. As to whether this strategy is going to be you know, rolled out in the kind of in a large scale or make a big dent on the upcoming distress, I don't believe so.
I'd agree with you there. I think that we're actually seeing legislation in Texas against them, trying mm-hmm. to prohibit them from being created in the future because they're taking so many properties off the tax roll. But I just wanted to get your thoughts, seeing as we just had a deal like that. And
yeah, there'll be tremendous resistance to this. Yeah. Like they're, you know, states that do not charge, you know, state income tax, like Texas, are incredibly dependent on property right. taxes. Exactly. So as this starts to proliferate, there will be massive legislative pressure to stop it from happening.
Which makes the properties that are in these PFCs even more valuable.
That's right.
I want to jump back for a second. So you mentioned we were on a good topic of syndicators buying these properties for compressed cap rates, where we are, the distress. So you're Neil, and how do you like going forward, you know, who are the types of syndicators you would invest with, and how would you go about identifying those syndicators in the upcoming market? So, you know, you Neil's making a decision as a passive LP, vetting these operators. You know, I want to be on the bus that's buying these properties that are distressed and buying into an opportunity as interest rates go down. But what is that avatar of operator syndicator, and how do you find it?
You know, I'll give you multiple different answers. My first answer is, let's say me right now, I'm giving $100,000 to somebody. I want to simply say, can you send me the last few investor updates or preferably the last webinar that you did on all the properties that you have purchased in the last 3 years, 2020, 2021, 2022. I don't care about what you've done with 2023 because obviously at this point you've adjusted. I want to see a bunch of things. So firstly, I'm hopeful that that syndicator will be transparent enough because there are no syndicators that can say none of our properties have any bleed, right? Because if he's saying that, then I'm actually skeptical. Right, could happen, but it's difficult for that to happen. So, firstly,
when people say that, I always say, if you say that, it's because you haven't had enough experience yet,
right?
Or you're
yeah, it's basically yeah, exactly. It's really one of those two, right? So, yeah. So you know, so first, I want to see how they react to that. I want to see what is their reaction when I'm asking them for information on properties that I'm not invested in. There's the usual, oh, there's confidentiality issues. It's like, come on, look at the homepage of your website. I mean, you're screaming about all the properties that you made money on. Wouldn't you suggest that would also be subject to confidentiality? So come on, stop bullshitting me. Give me information about these properties. And then when you go in, I'm not worried about the fact that some of their properties are bleeding. I'm really worried about what are they doing? How are they thinking about this? How are they reacting? How are they adjusting? Because the thing is, when a typhoon hits, it affects everybody. But some people take better action against a typhoon than other people, right? A hurricane, right? Whatever it might be. Bottom line is you want to see how they adjusted, and you really want to see how they adjusted early in this process and how they changed their methodology. Next, you want to see what percentage of the properties that they bought were with fixed debt. Were they just bridge 100% of the way through, or did they start to pivot and say, we'll do some properties with bridge, we'll do some properties with fixed, right? They started to change their methodology and understand the market. They started to learn. Those are all the things that I'm looking for. I'm not looking for some white knight. Because if there was a white knight, they're not in the syndication industry. They were working with those institutionals.
They're
so I think, yeah, exactly. I mean, they're outside of the syndication industry, right? So but bottom line is we all lived within the syndication industry. In general, I'm more inclined to work with people that bought less properties, right? So I think that it was a time when all of us were having these meetings with our underwriters that were very contentious meetings with the underwriters basically trying to force us to change our criteria, and the approval committee saying no, right? So we all did that. So I want to know how well we did our job, because the truth is, we should have bought very few properties.
I know. I'll speak personally. It was a disaster in 2022 for us because we couldn't underwrite. I mean, we didn't know how to underwrite properties basically for a period of time. We know how to underwrite. Don't get me wrong, but the market had changed so fast. Nobody saw, you know, the lid had popped off the Fed, and we were just going wild. And it was like, I mean, we walked away from deals that we had under contract, and I mean, we retraded on properties because of the interest rates going up so much. I mean, even in like the 6 month or 3 month period that we were under contract, interest rates went up 200 basis points or whatever it was.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, it was 2022 was fun, so to speak. It was a little bit,
was completely crazy. Right. And even the beginning of 2022, you could start to see that the wheels are going to come off of this. I cheated, actually. What I did was, firstly, I went back and built a bunch of properties, right? If prices are that outrageous, I started building in 2018. So I had a bunch of properties that were built that I wasn't planning on selling, by the way, because they were cash flowing like crazy. But I'm like, you know, if somebody's going to give me a really stupid price on these and going basically give me the next 10 years of my cash flow today, I'll just take it, right? And so I pivoted, I built, and I sold. So I was so busy selling and so busy building that I missed a bunch of my the meetings where my underwriters would pressure me to change my criteria. And so that's why I ended up only buying two.
That's excellent. Love it.
And by the way, one of them is bleeding, right? So that one, I'm just feeding it the bleed with my money.
Yeah.
Neil, I want to get into the build to rent thing before we wrap up and yep. talk about your company a little bit. Before we do that, I feel like we started, you know, the first half hour of this podcast has been very tight on multifamily, tightly focused. Okay. Let's zoom out to the whole forest here, because I just listened to an hour of your interview with Bronson Hill this morning from January, and you have so much great context and knowledge and wisdom in terms of broad context. What's happening with the Fed? What's happening with the single family market? What's happening with China? Can you just sort of play economist here for the next 10 minutes and just unload on us in terms of, like, give pilots who are making great money in their W-2, some the best that they've ever made, give us a broad context of what's happening in the world right now, and then let's sort of pivot into where the opportunities because of that.
Sounds good. I'll start by saying thank you, pilots, including Captain Kangaroo, who bounced me to the terminal last week. I love all of you, even the last one. I think that this is actually one of those weird good times for pilots to be investing, right? So here's what's happened. You as a pilot made an investment 24 months ago, and then you made another one 18 months ago, and then you made another one 12 months ago. And many of those investments are not doing well today. They may not be cash flowing. In fact, they may be murmurs of, you know, of cash calls, or maybe even an actual one or two cash calls. I want to say this to you. It is a capital mistake, the kind of mistake that Warren Buffett would never make, to think that the past is like the present, or that the past is like the future, because it rarely ever is. So what happened in the last 12 months has already happened. There's nothing that you can do to change it. But what you don't want to do is to miss out on opportunity today simply because you're grumpy about what happened to you in the last 24 months, right? So, and I'll point this out to you. If you did invest 3 years ago, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, well, those investments went swimmingly, went fantastically well, right? So you need to understand that what happened in the last 12 months is reversing. And it's now at this point, today, it's reversing in your favor. The last 18 months, it's been, you know, against you. So if you were willing to make an investment or willing to consider an investment into real estate 12 months, 18 or 24 months ago, and you're not willing to consider that investment today, you're not an investor. You're just a speculator. A speculator follows the market. When things are bad, they don't invest. When things are good, they invest. That's speculation. An investor understands market cycles and says, when things are bad, there's always going to be negative buzz, and I want to make the investment then. As Warren Buffett said, right, be fearful when others are greedy, and be greedy when others are fearful. Ryan and I were fearful in 2022, right? But at this point, we're like, the next 12 months, as a bunch of these properties go back to the bank, we might get discounts greater than what we should be entitled to, given the economic fundamentals being strong. So that's my message to you. please be an investor, don't be a speculator. And most people are inclined to be there. Now, the background of this is the economy. I'm just stunned by how well the US economy has done. If I go back, and you know, I'm a nerd, I'm a geek, you can tell that. I'm looking at the last, you know, since 1945, I'm looking at every time the Federal Reserve has raised rates, and they've done so 9 times, by the way. 8 of those times, they put the economy into a recession. One of them, they almost put us into a recession, so pretty much 100%. But not a single time out of those 9 times was the economy as resilient as it is today. Understand this, we have just gone through the fastest rate hike in history, right? No other rate hike comes close to what we just did in the last 12 months. But in every single one of those rate hikes, unemployment jumped. We started this rate hike. The day that we started the rate hike, our unemployment rate in the United States was 3.5%. Today, after 12 months of the Fed throwing hand grenades at the economy, it's 3.4%. So it's gone down 0.1% at the same time that the Fed has raised interest rates by 525 basis points. That's 520, but for those of you, it's 5.25% higher in interest rates than it was when they started. That's how astonishingly strong this economy is.
It's incredible.
Why in God's name would you not want to be an investor in an economy this strong? I know there's a recession coming. Good. It's a good thing. Recessions are what help smooth out the economic cycle. They take out the weak companies. They take out the weak syndicators. They take out the weak anything. They are the garbage collection methodology for a highly functional economy. So if you don't get a recession every 3 or 4 years, that's when I'd be worried and stop investing. If you get a recession every 3 or 4 years, and we did have a brief one in 2020 because of COVID, so this is really coming 3 years after that or 3.5 years after that, that's good. Why would you not want to invest because of that? I think that there are incredible things happening in our economy. I can tell you this. I have never been more bullish on the United States than I am today. Never been more bullish on the US. That's because I'm very highly resistant to Fox News and MSNBC.
Yep.
Because it is their job to make you fearful. I read economic data. You know, I was listening to a live presentation that Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger were doing. Charlie is now almost 100 years old. I think he's going to be 100 years old in a few days. So I think he knows a few things. Warren Buffett's fund has outperformed or crushed the S&P 90% of the years that they've been running it. So they know a few things. They've never been more bullish. And the reason for that is technology. What we are doing with generative AI will change the face of our planet. We've finally gone from having, you know, really expensive EVs that make no fundamental sense to having really cheap EVs, right? Today, a Tesla Y is cheaper than the average car in America and still dropping. Why? Because Tesla has finally achieved economies of scale and batteries now are, what, an eighth of a price compared to what they were when Tesla started. So all these things that we've been saying about this doesn't make sense were true, but they're no longer true. And so we're transitioning into an economy that is extraordinarily energy rich and extraordinarily artificial intelligence rich. And I think that that raises all boats. When? I don't know. 1 year, 2 years, 3 years from now, but not 5 years, because artificial intelligence is moving years at the speed of, you know, in weeks. We are seeing, you know, and you can ask me a question about that. I'll give you something that'll blow your mind. But that's the economy that we are going into. And the US is leading the world in this. There's a lot of this talk about petrodollars. Who cares about petrodollars when we are now the largest producer of any kind of energy in the world? We have more natural gas being exported today to the United States than Saudi Arabia and Russia combined. We are pulling more shale out of the earth at an ever lower cost. Shale prices went from, you know, $60 a barrel to get shale out of the earth to $38 a barrel as of yesterday, based on oilprice.com, my favorite website. When I look at that, we're one of the richest energy-rich countries in the world. We have debt, federal debt, but it's at 123% of GDP. China's at 370%, Japan's at 330%. Even India, which is seen to be the other great country of next 100 years, even their debt is higher than ours. And we are the reserve currency of the world. I think we can go from 130% of GDP in debt to 390%. If Japan can get to 370% without being the reserve currency of the world, with negative population growth for the last 3 decades, we can get there. So I'm not saying that's not a problem. I think it's terrible. I'm saying that there's a lot of other things that people are ignoring because they just focus on one bad thing. That, you know, either it's climate change is going to kill us all or the debt's going to kill us all. They take that and they stop looking at all the other inputs that matter. And if you look at all of those inputs, the United States is in an extraordinary position.
Really is. I share that sentiment.
What are you most excited about with AI and its advancement in the economy specifically? Is there any way that you're using it differently? I mean, I'll say personally, I just set up a training program internally at Spartan, and I went on this app called Trainial. It was crazy. I uploaded a video, and then it's like, do you want me to build a lesson plan for you? And I was like, yes. And then a lesson plan was just built instantly. And I was like, wow. I mean, and then, you know, openai.com and ChatGPT and all that. But what jazzes you the most about AI?
The fact that it's only 4.5 months old and we are all so excited, right? Or yeah. 6.5 months old. So the world changed on November 29th, 2022. The largest change in the history of the world since the invention of the steam engine was November 29th, 2022, the day that ChatGPT came out. ChatGPT doesn't matter. They have no moat. I don't even believe the company is going to be around in 5 years. Because of what happened between March 3rd and March 19th, those 16 days will go down in history as pivotal to human civilization. On March 3rd, the AI that Facebook wrote leaked. So it went into the wild. By March 15th, people have taken the source code and managed to get it running on a MacBook. You know, it took Facebook $1 billion of processing to basically get the damn thing running on a data center the size of a Costco. And in 15 days, the open source market had converted that successfully into code that ran on a single MacBook. And that is stunning because now the cost of training an AI has gone from $1 billion to $300. Literally, this is $300 to train an AI. You know why? Because now we're training on trained AI. So what we're doing is basically, and I don't know if this is legal or not, but it's open source, so nobody can sue anybody. We are taking the responses from ChatGPT and using those to train a new AI. And now we're able to train the $1 billion or $10 billion that OpenAI spent essentially is wasted. All of that money is wasted because we can just take the trained responses and build an engine off of that and now cost hundreds of dollars. So our society is about to see a truly extraordinary change because of artificial intelligence. I think that this is the way I look at it. Compare this to the smartphone revolution. By the way, this is 1,000 times more important than the smartphone revolution, but compare it to that. Do you know where we are today? I mean, I mentioned November 29th and we're recording this in May. Steve Jobs is still on the stage. He's still holding the first iPhone ever and still telling you about its 3.5-inch screen. That's where we are in the AI age. He hasn't even left the stage yet. And we have thousands of companies that have already started. It's not OpenAI. I don't think they mean anything at all. It's not even Google's AI. It's not Bard. It's not Bing. We are going to build artificial intelligence into every single tool that we use. And we're going to build specific artificial intelligence. For example, we are going to create AI to answer the question of where is the cheapest and best place to build a hydroelectric dam in the world? And AI will give us an answer that's better than any human ever can. And the answer probably is in the Congo because they have, you know, 3,000 rivers. So we'll actually backtest that against what we think is happening. Now take that example, multiplied by billions of questions, and AI will solve it all. Tesla will ask, how do we get the cost of the Tesla Y from $45,000 to $33,000, right? You can't get it down to $10. And give AI that information, and the answers that will come out will be stunning. What we've seen already is general purpose AI completely destroys human intelligence when you compare it. Remember, from ChatGPT 3.5 to 4 was 2.5 months. We went from having a 10% passing score on the bar exam for ChatGPT to crushing the bar exam with ChatGPT-4, crushing it, more so than most lawyers do that have put 5 or 10 years of work into passing the bar exam. all of that in a few months, and we're even in an industry that doesn't even have the software tools written yet, it's going to be absolutely astonishing.
So I'm going to say the thing that none of us want to hear, and that's that if you're a pilot out there, you know, they're still building airplanes with two pilot cockpits, but, you know, it's, you can't just bury your head in the sand and think that this isn't going to change someday. So, you know, the goal is to build passive income, invest and build passive income so that you can invest your way out of a job before the brick wall comes, right?
Man, what a good segue. That was perfect.
That's why inevitable. That's why it completely makes sense. I think that, you know, most pilots know the airline industry is one of the slowest moving industries, so they're good for a little while. But don't be overconfident. We are seeing things happen in weeks. My uncle owns over 100 Burger Kings. He says, he's one of the Burger King, franchisees that they fly to their headquarters when they have a franchisee that's doing badly, right? Mm-hmm. And he comes in and takes over their franchises. So they took him to their headquarters. Burger King headquarters is in Florida. And they showed him a version of ChatGPT that had an overlay of Burger King. And he says, it was the most astonishing thing I've ever seen. There's a screen in front of you, and he's just talking. You're having a conversation, regular conversation. I want ketchup. I want this. I want that. You know, I don't want this. I don't want that. And as you're doing it, you know, it's got visual. You know, it's a person, and you know, they're changing and saying, okay, yeah. You know, just having a normal conversation, and then on the right side, your order is building, right? And it's building it in real time on the right side while you're standing there ordering. He said, after I talked with this person, I never, ever want to order with a human being again because the emotions were so true. The smile, he was like, I felt like this was the best server I had ever trained, and I've trained hundreds of them in the last 20 years. And all of that based on 8 weeks of work.
Okay, so what are your thoughts here? I don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole, but you know, everybody seems to freak out every time there's a new invention that there's going to be all this massive job loss and we're going to have to bring in universal basic income. And that, what do you see? What does history tell us about that?
Well, we've never had job losses because of technology. I don't think we're going to start now. Please look at the last 300 year of track record of job losses. You know, we changed to the steam engine. We changed to the motor vehicle, we changed to aircraft, we changed to renewable energy, we changed to lots and lots of things. And the net effect of every single one of those was a gain in jobs. Keep in mind that 35% of Americans were tilling fields 100 years ago, 35%. Today, the number is slightly lower than 1% of Americans. 1% of Americans are farmers today. It was 35%. What happened to those 34? Did they die? Did they starve to death? No, they went on to do value-add jobs and had a tremendous gain in their net worth, had a tremendous gain in their quality of life. And I think we're going to see further quality of life gains. Now, what does happen, which is perfectly normal, is you can see a drop over a certain five-year period of time as the world adjusts to this. And then you basically create a new set of value-add jobs that sit on top of the AI. Someday AI will no longer need us and universal basic income will come in. But I think we're many, many, many decades away from that. Yeah, so is it something to worry about for a current investor? No, unless you're looking to invest for 50 years, I wouldn't worry about it at all.
Yeah, it's like when Zoom came out or teleconferences came out, they're like, oh, it's going to kill the airline industry and no one's going to want to travel and all the business is going to be online. It's like, no, that didn't
happen. Yeah, I mean, the airline industry is the largest and the most profitable that it's ever been. Right? So you look at how much money Boeing is making, even though they're screwing up, and look at how much money Airbus is making, even though they're screwing up. I mean, just astonishing, right? And the number of aircraft flying is much larger than it's ever been. The point is this, the only way to increase productivity without increasing the number of people is technology. Technology is the loophole that allows you to increase your salary without having an increase, without having a backlash from employers, because the employer is able to get more done. So they now basically productivity increases. When productivity increases, guess what happens? GDP increases, people buy more things. It is a virtuous loop of people having more money and then basically employers using more AI, creating more productivity, which creates another virtuous loop. In an environment where you have this kind of technology, disruptive technology, we could easily get productivity increases that are 50% higher for 20 years. That creates hundreds of trillions of dollars of wealth.
Yeah, it's like, it's, I think, you know, relating this to the pilot, it's RNAV RMP approaches and SIDS and STARS and all the technology advancements with GPS. It put more airplanes in the sky with closer...
10x more airplanes in the sky.
Yeah, closer, right? Closer separation with the same, you know, with more efficiency, right? And it made the economy more profitable overall. Yeah. Made the airlines more profitable.
And resilient. An economy that is based on efficiency is always more resilient. And that's why the United States is ranked as one of the most efficient countries in the world. We're a true market economy. We make our mistakes. We make huge numbers of mistakes. But in general, if you look at the efficiency, you'd be surprised at, you know, is a factory in China cheaper than a factory in America? You, nearly a third of all different kinds of factories are cheaper in the United States than in China.
This is efficiency. Go ahead, Ryan.
Now, I was going to say, so you mentioned earlier that the Fed is going to lower rates and the 100-pound weight on the chest is just that, and going up will be inconsequential a little bit, but eventually that's going to go down in November. Now, if you log on to the Chatham Financial site and any financial projection tool that gives you a forecast in interest rates, it all agrees with you. But why? Why is it going to go down? What's your opinion on that?
Because the Fed wants it to go down. The Federal Reserve has publicly said many, many times that the equilibrium rate is 2%. The equilibrium rate is the rate at which the Fed neither hurts nor helps the economy. It just simply is even. The economy is running by itself because it doesn't need intervention from the Fed. We are at 5.25%. The Fed wants to get back to 2%. The Fed doesn't want to interfere in the economy either in a good way or a bad way. Unfortunately, all that money printing, which by the way was mostly politicians, though the Fed gets the bad rap, led to the Fed basically being forced to intervene and slow the economy down. Once the economy is slowed down enough, the Fed doesn't want to have anything to do with the economy. They want to get back to 2%. That is the equilibrium rate. So the Fed, if they can jack rates up to slow the economy down, they can also pull them down to stop interfering.
And if you're listening and you're not understanding what the two equilibrium rate that Neil is referencing, it's the overnight borrowing rate that basically banks are being charged to borrow funds. So that went from basically zero to 5.25 in most of 2022.
Yeah,
and
13 months.
Yep, and the Fed is predicting it, I think, last time I checked, to go down to about 2.5, I think, by the end of 2025. The last time I looked, I haven't looked in a little while, but...
That's right. And typically, the Fed will actually predict something that's a little bit slower than what they actually do because they don't want the market to start to boom. The Fed actually does not like the stock market booming at all. The Fed wants, you know, slow and gradual growth. It knows that bubbles are created when the market booms. So whatever they are planning to do, they give you a slightly bearish picture of that. That's very common, and many Fed governors have said that once they get off the Fed seat.
Got it.
I have some data here that the shortest gap between a rate hiking cycle into a rate lowering was 1 month.
That's
the
right.
Longest was 20 months, yep, in 1970. So if this last month's rate hike was the final plateau and the last hike, we could be, what would be your prediction based on the current economy? How long it'll take them
off to start cutting rates? Off the nine hikes that the Fed has done since Second World War, as you correctly said, one of them was 20 months. But actually look at how many times they raised to hit that plateau. And the answer is it was a very shallow plateau. That example actually doesn't correspond to what we've done. We've just had a Mount Everest of spikes, right? So we've had to raise very, very fast. Whereas in 1970, they raised a few times and then sat on a plateau for a long time because they were like, this is fine. Now there's a 10-pound chest on the economy, so I can sit there for 20 months. I can tell you that, leave alone the U.S. economy, the U.S. government cannot sustain a 5.25% interest rate for 20 months. Why? Because today, the federal debt, which has to be refinanced every day, right? There's a certain number of treasuries that come up for refinance every day, is now being refinanced at 5.25% or whatever, well, a little lower than that, 4%, which is, you know, 30-year treasury debt and 10-year treasury debt. So when you're looking at the combination of that, the economy can sustain high interest rates for a certain amount of time. But beyond that, what ends up happening is all of the money, all of the tax receipts that we get end up going into interest. There's no money to pay the Pentagon. There's no money to pay Social Security or Medicare. The government knows this, but they're patient because they know that the alternative is even worse. If we don't get inflation under control, then that alternative, that world, you wouldn't even want to live in it. So the alternative is to basically just suck up the fact that now our, you know, our the federal debt's interest rate is going up. But I know that roughly by the end of this year, if they don't start bringing it down, we will start to see severe challenges with the government not having enough money to pay its employees. So there will be a tremendous amount of pressure to bring it down.
And so what are your best picks now? What's your best move when it comes to maybe even just traditional and non-traditional assets?
Right now, I'm focused on what I call ultra-cheap BTR. I have dabbled with massive amounts of build-to-rent. I have dabbled with very expensive build-to-rent, medium and cheap, and I've actually settled on ultra-cheap BTR. That is my best bet because I still don't believe that multifamily pricing makes sense. I am now able to consistently make townhomes in tertiary markets in the United States. I don't touch, you know, the big markets, where the year's rent for a tenant living in a three-bedroom brand new property is $20,000 a year. And that is my goal. I want to build, my life's work is, I want to build 10,000 units in the next 10 years for the middle class America. And I define middle class America as people who have a salary of $56,000 to $75,000. I'm not interested in all those class A people above that $75,000 because that's really where class A apartments begin, the really in the fancier cities, right? So you $2,000 a month and then rents go higher than that. I'm fixated on, I need to put people in brand new townhomes, not apartments, townhomes, front yard, backyard. And I need to be able to do it for less than $20,000 a year of rent. And so I am working out different kinds of materials, different kinds of methodologies, different kinds of cities where I can actually get that done. And now I have proof. And so I'm basically working with a bunch of investors, showing them that proof and saying, find me a product that's more compelling in the United States that produces more than 30% average returns. And they haven't answered that question, but I keep going around asking people.
Yeah, we built a mobile home park actually 2 years ago, and 217 pad community, double wide lots. And, you know, I got tons of calls after that because we found this 38 acres that we entitled to build multifamily or a manufactured housing community, built it, and we could, you know, charge $500-$600 for rents, and you still had to buy the home. So the tenant had to buy a $225,000 to $250,000 home. Now that went up a lot, COVID, more to like $300,000. But I mean, people were banging down my door. How did you find a community that even allowed manufactured housing to be built? So the fact that you are on this quest to find townhouses, which communities love, right? They don't love manufactured housing communities.
Right.
And to give them at that cost, I mean, if you figure that out, I mean, you're gonna change the world. I mean, that is a massively in demand market and in investment worthy. So where are you?
I have 5 to 6 month wait lists at the completed communities, and I'm not raising the prices because I'm able to come in at that 25% to 30% AAR for investors. I'm able to bring cash flow in, so I'm trying to keep things a little balanced because my mission itself is not served if I go and jack up those rents to $2,000 a month. Right. So it's really about 1600, 1700. If you want 2-car garages, I'm at 1800. If you want 1-car garages, I'm at 1700. That's my mission. And I am not seeing a product in the United States that's comparable. As you said, manufactured housing beats my product in math. No doubt about it. The problem with manufactured housing, as you well know more than anybody else, is nobody wants it, right? So you're fighting an uphill battle for each community. It almost gets to the point where it's like, is this worth my while, and am I just doing it for social justice reasons? Whereas townhomes are highly welcomed in any market where they can work, especially when I tell people it is my mission to come in under $20,000 a year of rent.
Yeah.
I love that. And for anybody who's not clear on what manufactured housing is, yeah. It's
I think in the 70s, right?
I think that is the biggest travesty of justice in America. Yeah. Yep. That we don't have federal mandates on every city in America that there should be a certain number of mobile home parks. We would fix the housing crisis in an instant if we said 5% of all housing in every single city in America has to be manufactured housing. We would completely fix the problem, right? Wow. It is just a total travesty of justice.
True. I'll take it a step.
Nobody wants it in their backyard.
Affordable housing is a man-made problem. And if we want to get rid of it, we just get rid of zoning laws.
Yes. I think that we are going in that direction. The challenge is, once you get rid of zoning laws, all you've really done is increase the amount of land that's available for new construction. But unfortunately, people are still constructing too many high-end properties. There's too much Class A construction, right? So 93% of all construction in the United States for, let's call them apartments, is Class A construction. So to me, I think that solves one half of the problem. It gives you more land availability, which is great. But I think what really needs to happen is something like manufactured housing needs to be allowed through federal mandates. And boy, we would fix that. There wouldn't be a person in America that wouldn't have a roof over their head if we fixed that problem. But I don't see that, you know, the political divides are not going to work. Yeah. And so my job is, let's just build townhomes. Nobody complains about townhomes.
Nope.
Yeah. And I'm not building expensive townhomes. I don't do clubhouses. I don't do gyms. There's no gyms. There's no pools. I'm, you know, because when you buy a single family home, 9 out of 10 times when you buy a starter single family home at an income of 60,000, it doesn't have a pool. It doesn't have a gym. It's just a home. It's just a home. Right. Front yard, backyard, 3 bedrooms.
Yep.
Right? So I'm trying to give people that in $20,000 a year. And then they can go find their own gym half mile away. I don't build at the edges of cities. I build in infill. So they can just walk to the gym.
Well, you go to those common areas. You go to those common areas, and nobody's in them anyway.
How many, you go
to the conference rooms, and
they're all empty. I mean, I'm all of my fancy Class A apartments that I've built, every single time I go to the clubhouse, there's like one person sitting there. Yeah. It's so annoying, right? But my
That's
property
true.
Managers have
That's
told true. Me, if you're building Class A, I need a pool because I can't lease up the unit. It, you know, it's the sizzle that sells, not the steak. I get that. So, but it's like, okay, well, I'll build a few of those. But my mission in life is to solve something. My mission in life is very simple. 10,000 townhome units under $20,000 a year in rent. I'll mostly just build that.
Love it.
I love it. And I want to just plug this because build to rent is, as you said, one of the hottest asset classes in commercial real estate. And there's how much institutional
money? So $75 billion has gone in. And that is sort of split between townhome built to rent and single family built to rent. I do. When they started out, it seemed like 80% of it was going to single family. Now the construction costs have gone up like crazy, and it looks like it's more 80% townhome now at this point that's being built. So built to rent is the middle piece between single family home construction and apartment construction, right? Because that 55 to 75K audience does not want to live in apartments, but does not have the money to buy single family homes. Right, but it's actually a pretty nice group of people, mostly families, and so I'm catering to that middle America. And by the way, I'm not suggesting that I've found a solution. I have not. My solution currently only works in tertiary markets. It does not work in secondaries. It does not work in primary. So I'm like, yeah, but my life's work will be done if I can get 10,000 of these units built. Let somebody else figure out the problem to solution to a secondary market.
Well, speaking of primary, secondary, and tertiary markets, you are the man when it comes to where to buy real estate. Check out Neil Bawa's Location Magic. You can probably find it on YouTube or Grow Capitus. Neil, you want to tell us about where people can find that? Because I think it's super interesting if you are interested in actually buying rental property to go through that little course that Neil has. Additionally, you have tons of educational material. So how do people
Location Magic first, right? So the best way to find it is the Udemy website. So type in UDEMY. Udemy is the world's largest website for online courses. The course is free. It's always meant to be free. There's no subscription. There's no upsell. So type in Udemy space Neil Bawa. And you'll find your way to a course. Currently have 12,000 nerdy investors taking the course. So you'll see about 12,000 that are taking it right now. You'll see thousands of five-star reviews. And if you read the reviews and you like them, that's what you'll get in the course itself. The purpose of the course is to demystify how to pick markets, right? And completely unknown markets that you've never even heard of, right? If you want to compare Punta Gorda to Logan, Utah. Well, which one of those is better? And how much better? Is Logan twice as better? Yeah. What about comparing Idaho Falls to Madison, Wisconsin, right? Which of these two markets is better and why? That demystification is done. And the goal is simple. You should be able to rank a market in 10 minutes or less. So I took all the elements out of the data science that I couldn't do in 10 minutes. So the course only includes those elements. Obviously, internally, we do a lot more. But I can tell you 9 times out of 10, we come up with the same list of cities because the big kahunas, the big elements, the ones that matter the most, are all included in those 10 minutes. So all the other ones that we're doing, we end up with the same list, right? And this list, it changes from time to time. Though, you know, most people don't change their markets very often. I change my markets every year. It's actually more every 18 months, I'd say, because it's just so exhausting to change markets, right? But there's so many interesting markets in the United States right now. Rogers, Arkansas is incredible. Huntsville, Alabama continues to be incredible. I see all of these amazing markets, right? So I see markets in South Dakota that are doing really, really well. There's just so many interesting markets that are growing at 2, 3, 4, or even 5 times the US rate. There's places where job growth is 2, 5, 10 times the US average. Job growth, 10x, right? Those markets are incredible. And yeah. And their constructability, their construction costs are low enough so that in many of them, I'd say maybe 1/3 of those amazing markets, I can build something where a brand new townhome can be rented for under $20,000 a year of rent. That's, by the way, just in case you're wondering, that's about $1,650 a month in rent.
Amazing. And what about your mega trends?
All of those are at a website called multifamilyu.com. Now, don't worry about the name. There's tons of single family data in there. We're doing a webinar that's coming up talking about what's happening in the office industry and the retail industry. You know, the office apocalypse is about to hit, and we'll be talking about that. So the website's called multifamily followed by the letter u.com. That's multifamilyu.com. But we do 12 webinars a year. We get about 25,000 nerds and geeks that join us for those webinars. Typically, so there's about 2,000, 2,500 people that join us for each webinar. They're free. They're meant to be free. We have no education product. We have no interest in education besides what we offer for free. It's really about conversations, interesting conversations with interesting people. All of the people that are my partners have come from these. All of the people that are my employees have come from these. So to me, it makes all the sense in the world to continue that conversation. So in the next couple of months, we'll be doing one that'll be talking about the coming debacle in commercial real estate. Note, multifamily is not considered commercial real estate. And then there'll be another one talking about the distress coming in multifamily itself. And then we'll be doing one about how artificial intelligence will change the world, which has nothing to do with real estate. I do webinars very often on things that interest me that have very little to do with real estate.
Well, I think having a global perspective is that's excellent. And you know, is important. So
I think so. And you know, you should be able to have Absolutely. Any kind of interesting conversation, right? And to be in a room with 1,000 people with lots of interesting conversations, often when I do webinars, the Q&A session at the end is 75 minutes long because there's like so many interesting questions to answer. So it is the most fun part of my job. So why should I restrict myself just to real estate? I just did one about the impact of climate change. I did have a section on it called Impact of Climate Change on Real Estate, but it was only like 7 slides. The rest of it was really just about climate change, right? Whether it's caused by, I don't actually even get into the, is climate change caused by, you know, burning fossil fuels. It's like, that's a political debate and I don't want to get into it. But I know climate change, as it happens, what is the impact that it's having on communities? What is the impact it's having on construction costs and insurance costs? That's a very interesting conversation to have.
Right. It's tangible.
Yeah.
Well, and we'd be remiss not mentioning your investment firm, Grow Capitus, right? So would you like to talk briefly about that before we sign off?
Yeah. So Grow Capitus is a data-driven firm, you know, a bunch of nerds and geeks. My partner is a software architect. So she drives the firm forward in this data-driven environment. We have about 900 investors. A lot of them are from Silicon Valley, technologists, Apple employees, folks like that, doctors. And we are very erratic. So sometimes we'll offer 5 projects and sometimes we will offer nothing for 2 years straight. And you just have to live with that. But if you're interested, you can go to Grow Capitus. That's G-R-O, no W, Capitus, C-A-P-I-T-U-S.com and join our erratic bunch.
I love it. Neil Bawa, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, guys.
Appreciate it.